Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest up today, Christian Parenti. Christian's been on this show many times. Today he's here to discuss his new book, Tropic of Chaos, just out from Nation Books. Christian's been covering war and state collapse in some of the most dire regions on Earth for the last decade or so. Tropic of Chaos is a study of how climate change is adding a new layer of misery to a region already ravaged by imperialism and neoliberalism, a portent for our future as the weather gets more hostile and resources more scarce. First, a few words in the news. The mostly weak tone of U.S. economic data continues, following the precedent of disappointment set by the torpid employment report for May, released in early June. We'll get the June numbers the morning of July 8th. First-time claims for unemployment insurance fell only slightly last week, and the four-week average remains quite high, not at recession levels, but at stalling recovery levels. The number of people continuing to draw benefits had been in a long downtrend, but that stalled out in April, and is now flat. At least it's not rising, but if the recovery weren't losing oomph, it would have extended its decline from its still high levels of a couple of months ago. Meanwhile, the news from the housing market, whose recovery is probably a prerequisite to any broad economic recovery, continues to be ugly, with sales depressed and prices continuing to fall. It's weird when declining prices for one of life's essentials, shelter, is considered bad news, but that's the way our housing market works. There are about five different measures of house prices in common use, each of which sings a different variation on the same basic theme. After stabilizing early last year, prices started falling again as 2010 was turning into 2011. There are still too many vacant houses and too many houses in foreclosure hanging over the market to allow prices to recover. Since just about every economic recovery in modern times has been led by housing, this is not good news. Neither is the continued erosion of the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, which is designed to forecast turns in the economy several months out. The leading index is still positive, but for every one of the last 10 months, it's been less positive than the month before. As I've said before, I don't think we're headed back into recession, though that's always possible. Instead, I think we're experiencing a textbook post-bubble economy, lifeless, unable to get out of its own way. There are too many structural pathologies, inequality, debt, hollowing out, although the strength in manufacturing is surprising and hopeful for the longer term, that are unacknowledged and unaddressed. All anyone can do now is talk about cutting government spending, local, state, and federal, which will only exacerbate the weakness of the economy. The melodrama over the debt ceiling in D.C. is seriously depressing. It's a fact that if the Treasury were unable to make interest payments on its bonds, all hell could break loose in the financial markets. Not only are Treasury securities considered the safest in the world, a reputation that would be weakened if not destroyed by default, but there are also many complex arrangements that depend on the flow of Treasury interest to remain solvent. If that gets interrupted, who knows what kinds of repercussions that would have. Any disruption in the flow of interest payments would cause interest rates to rise dramatically and derail what little recovery we've had. Republicans seem willing to risk all that because they see the threat as a way to cut the budget viciously. It's a form of blackmail, really. And the threat is directed against someone, Barack Obama, who is famous for his preemptive compromises. But it may be wrong to see Obama as simply weak in this situation. He would almost certainly gain politically by saying publicly, loudly, and frequently that a Republican plan is a way of forcing cuts to immensely successful programs like Medicare and Social Security that we can well afford, and cuts that would not pass muster without the threat of crisis. But maybe he's not really opposed to such cuts. He may be hoping for more moderate ones than Paul Ryan is suggesting, but not opposed to the cuts in principle. When people consistently behave in ways that look irrational, you may just be missing the rationale behind their behavior. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Christian Parenti. Thank you. the second of 8 piano pieces by Hans Eisler, performed by Matthew Rubinstein, a friend of and listener to this program. Matt's CD, Berlin im Licht, that's Berlin in Light, is just out on Berlin Classics. It's a collection of piano pieces by the November Group, a collective of artists and musicians formed in Berlin after Germany's November Revolution in 1918. That revolution was led by the left in the wake of the Russian Revolution a year earlier. The leadership of the Social Democratic Party didn't want to go all the way with the revolution, and so kept part of the old imperial order intact, giving birth to the Weimar Republic, a culturally exciting but politically unstable thing that eventually collapsed, paving the way for Hitler. That's a vast oversimplification, but what do you expect in less than 100 words? My only guest today is Christian Parenti. Christian, a frequent guest in Behind the News, writes for The Nation and is the author of several books, including Lockdown America, about the prison system, The Soft Cage, which is about surveillance, public and private, and The Freedom, which is about the war in Iraq. Christian's latest book, just out from Nation Books, is Tropic of Chaos, a study of how climate change is making life worse in parts of the world already afflicted by neoliberalism and a plentiful supply of weapons. Christian Parenti. Welcome, Christian. I guess there have been a lot of books about climate change. How's yours different from the pack?
Well, I try to break the discussion of climate change out of the environmental and climate ghetto and connect it to issues of international development, war, and political economy in ways that other books haven't. It's based on several years of travel and reporting from failed and semi-failed states and war zones and struggling places around the world, and also based on a lot of historical research and political economic thought. And I try to tie all this together and continually bring out the climatological aspect in the history and current iteration of the crisis that one sees all across the global south, which expresses itself or appears as civil war, ethnic pogroms, religious violence, banditry, mass migration, general chaos and violence.
What is this Tropic of Chaos in the title?
Well, it's a reference to this belt of states. I mean, really, in many ways, you know, it's like I became interested in failed states from reporting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the whole concept of failed states is something that the left, at first, as I recall, sort of saw as a kind of right-wing notion.
Well, it's a staple of bourgeois discourse, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's a staple of a particular type of kind of muscular, interventionist, crypto-racist bourgeois discourse, Kaplan being the best example of that. But, you know, there are actual failed states. And
What's the definition?
You know, I don't know if there's a strict definition, but there's the Index for Peace has a kind of ranking of relative failure. But my definition would be that a failed state is where the government is totally hollowed out and cannot do any of the things that governments do. Never mind whether it's things that you like or don't like, but like cannot collect taxes, cannot pave any roads.
You give an example of a guy who writes a bogus travel document on the back of an imperial piece of paper, right?
Yeah. I was in the Congo, and I was trying to get travel permission, and they eventually gave me travel permission when I told them, look, I'm going to leave without it. And he gave me a document from 1957, printed out from the Belgian Congo, and on the back side of it, he had written in ballpoint pen something similar to what was on the original document. And to me, this document encapsulates the reality of failed states. So a lot of failed states or relatively failed states.
The ghostly presence of the colonial power.
Yeah. And you have the insignia, you have the offices, but there's no, you know, you have the police, say in Congo. You have the police around. They won't let you take photographs in Kinshasa. And if the cops see you taking photographs, they will arrest you and tell you that there's a huge fine and there's this law.
Just like a tourist kind of photo.
Yeah. Any kind of photo. I mean, I went through this. I took a photograph of this giant modernist space needle that looms over the slums. And, you know, they wanted a bribe. And so there's like the appearance of a police state, but there are no dossiers, there's no accountability, but there are people.
They don't have the infrastructure to keep that kind of intelligence.
Right. And so the police revert back to their kind of earliest sociological origins. They're just bands of armed men who who happen to be more legitimate than the thieves that they're competing with. And you know, in failed states, sometimes they are basically thieves with a modicum of legitimacy, and thieves who you might actually also maybe get some help from at times. And so anyway, I became interested in this whole category of failed states, and there was no left analysis of it. And what I try to do is give it a historical, political, economic look, you know, and explain that places like Somalia or Guinea-Bissau or Congo or Afghanistan, they didn't just emerge as failed states, and that one can push back against this crypto-racist subtext and really explain how imperialism basically produced failed states. You know, it produced these states. It went in many cases, not all, but in many cases, it went in and destroyed or significantly transformed the pre-existing societies, created states. The populations of those states, those colonies, fought back within the context that had been imposed upon them of these borders and laws. And you have the whole national independence movement and wars of national liberation, but then empire continues to exploit and undermine the states of the global south after World War One, and after World War Two, and it's like that history of proxy wars of World Bank and IMF imposed liberalization of economies, that is what produces state failure. So there is, I think, a left history of state failure.
Yep, you say that a lot of books about climate change are about the future, and yours is mostly a book of history. And the two important forces you identify in producing this climate crisis in failed states, or the climate is exacerbating these situations in failed states, but two forces being the Cold War and neoliberalism. So let's talk about the contribution of each of those. Cold War first. What's the heritage of that?
The effect of the Cold War was to litter the global south with light weaponry and groups of men trained in the arts of smuggling, assassination, interrogation.
And the Cold War often fomented ethnic division, didn't it?
Yeah, the U.S. In particular used ethnic minorities to in its counterinsurgency. I mean, a crucial component of counterinsurgency is building auxiliary forces, building locals. And so frequently the U.S. would use ethnic minorities as their local adjuncts. So the Hmong in Vietnam are a perfect example of this, you know. And in Laos, they would develop their own kind of ethnic insurgency. The U.S. special forces developed their own ethnic insurgency to undermine the communist forces and the Viet Cong. And similarly in Nicaragua with the Mosquito Indians, or in Colombia, the development of the paramilitaries, which have their earliest origins in the Colombian armed forces, the government nurturing these private paramilitary armies to help them. And then those forces never remain completely dependent on and beholden to their masters, and they become independent violent actors and help really destroy societies and become a real problem for even those who formed them to begin with. Basically what the Cold War overall does is that at the end of the Cold War, the Global South is full of groups of men who know how to fight, and they have guns, and they have training, and they've got these smuggling networks that they used to cross borders when they were mercenaries or when they were guerrillas or whatever. And the ideology and the larger, more noble motives are gone, and the methodology and the practices of war remain. And so,
and we just marked the 20th anniversary of the end of the USSR. So, but these things linger 20 years later.
Yeah, and so now, so that's very destabilizing. And then the other aspect of, you know, the other element is liberalization. So the World Bank and IMF have been demanding that indebted countries of the global south privatize state assets, cut support to small farmers and fishermen, cut spending on health care and education, and open their economies. And this has created increased inequality, increased poverty, in some situations increased rates of growth, but the wealth from that is unequally distributed, but in some cases it's created real stagnation. So these two forces of the Cold War with its like use of proxy forces and seeding the global south with weaponry and training, and then neoliberal structural adjustment creating these very unequal, impoverished societies with lots of tension and anomie where people are not connected to their old communities, they've been thrown out of their jobs or thrown off the land. This is the stage onto which climate change now arrives with its extreme weather, its floods, its droughts. And so you can't really look at climate change outside of the context of that history. So like take a place like Afghanistan. Climate change is not the cause of the war. But one thing climate change is doing in Afghanistan, there's been the worst drought in living memory. And that's kind of where I started thinking about writing this book, was in Afghanistan, interviewing poppy farmers who kept mentioning the drought. And one thing that happened was the drought didn't stop. The drought went on and on and on for now about a decade. And they explained that this was really important why they grew poppy. And at first I didn't really hear it. It was in my notes. I don't even put it in my articles. And later I realized, that, wait, that's quite significant. You know, and I looked into it more. And it turns out that poppy uses one-fifth the amount of water of wheat. And it's similarly advantaged compared to other traditional Afghan crops like apricots and raisins and stuff like that. So the NATO occupation and the Afghan government attack poppy, at least in rhetoric and sometimes actually with eradication. The Taliban defend the farmers' right to grow poppy. So there's an element in why young men in the Pashtun areas of Afghanistan in the south join the Taliban, support the Taliban. Some of it has to do with their xenophobia and hostility towards Tajiks and certainly towards Americans and French and Dutch who are coming around. And some of it has to do with their religious beliefs and the grand stories that the Taliban organizers tell them. But some of it has to do with very basic material stuff. They can survive maybe if they grow poppy. The government and its foreign allies are not letting them do that. And the Taliban are saying, you know, we will protect you. We will drive these people who are threatening your livelihood out of this valley if you help us. So that's a very clear climatological aspect to why the war drags on, how the war is actually lived by the people on the ground.
I'm speaking with Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos, just out from Nation Books. And that title, Tropic of Chaos, you're referring mainly to the area of the globe between the two tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, right? So that's correct. What, 23 degrees on either side of the equator. Why that particular region?
Well, that's where one finds most of this, you know, incipient state failure, and that those were the front lines of the Cold War. And that was where European imperialism did most of its colonizing and state building. And really what this book is about is exploring the legacy of European colonialism in many ways. And that's where it mostly happened, was in those tropical and semi-tropical latitudes. And the entrance of climate change is also significant because those areas near the equator are experiencing extreme weather, kind of like the poles, in a rather more intensely than some mid-latitudes. And also because that band of terrain and the countries and economies within it, there's less economic development there. So people live closer to the land. There's, you know, much more vulnerability for the average person in southern India who's a farmer or, you know, a fisherman than there is in a more developed economy. And so that terrain, that belt of states, which I call the Tropic of Chaos, is where you find more people who really live with a very, very thin margin of error vis-a-vis the arrival of the rains, the behavior of the fish in the sea. And when the weather patterns become more extreme and erratic, which is what climate scientists say is going to be the pattern of climate change, though we can never say that this storm was caused by climate change and that one wasn't, or this one was and that one wasn't. But the general pattern is going in the direction that climate scientists have predicted, of increased precipitation, because there's more water in the atmosphere, because there's more heat in the atmosphere. But it comes down all at once, more violent storms, and then more drought, more erosion, and weather patterns that are no longer behaving as they always have. Rains that are supposed to come twice a year coming only once or coming at the wrong time. So that's why the book focuses on the area between the two tropics.
I just learned recently that there are economic models of the risk of government default, debt crises, that include the distance from the equator as an input. The closer you are to the equator, the more likely you are to default, of course.
Huh.
Now, you also look at resource wars. I mean, this nasty, hotter world, people are fighting over the real basics, like water and food, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the most direct examples of how climate change causes violence are local resource wars. So, like, in Kenya, pastoralists are shooting each other with guns that flow out of Somalia, the failed state.
You open the book with a guy whose head's been ripped open by a bullet, right?
No, yeah.
How'd he end up dead?
His name was Ekru Lorman, and he's a Turkana pastoralist, and he had been shot by the Pakot who came to raid his cattle. And cattle raiding is a traditional activity in the Horn of Africa, but it's become more intense and more violent. One, because there's all this light weaponry from the Cold War, and two, because all of the old supports that the state once had, livestock improvement programs, well drilling programs, all that stuff has been pulled back because of economic liberalization. So the pastoralists are really left to their own devices. And now what's hitting them? An almost decade-long drought, which has been punctuated occasionally by really, really extreme and sudden floods. So this is the context in which people like Ekru Larman find themselves, and they fall back on their own devices, which in many cases are AK-47s. So his people were grazing their herds, and the Pakot came down from these mountains, who were their traditional enemies, and tried to steal these cattle, and about six people were killed in this raid, and he was one of them. And that's going on all the time in northern Kenya. And there's also, a lot of ambushes on the roads. People are not just raiding each other's cattle, they're raiding buses and shooting passengers. All the buses have armed guards on them. The police go in with helicopters. The police look like soldiers. You see them at checkpoints. They're like in camo and carrying machine guns. And they go after these raiding parties. And then the raiding parties are sometimes connected to organized crime in Kampala and Nairobi, who will buy the cattle.
Well, they can put the cops in camouflage, but the state is really kind of weak and powerless, right?
Yeah. I mean, the state has no other programs other than this repressive response. And the repressive response by the Kenyan police is pretty minimal. I mean, they're just sort of like desperately trying to keep a lid on things. It's not...
They don't have the budget or the organization, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And now, Somalia. Somalia is like a watchword for social breakdown and crisis. So what?
Yeah. Well, that's
what led to this situation.
I mean, Somalia is like the ultimate failed state, and what created it was a classic case of Cold War proxy engagement. Fidel Castro was of his own initiative went to save Angola, went to save the MPLA from a CIA white South African engineered invasion on the eve of... This is a long answer, but anyway, this is how things go. So Fidel kind of...
Which deserves a long answer because nobody ever really talks about it.
Yeah, well, so it really begins in Angola. Fidel goes to the rescue of the socialist revolution in Angola in 1974 on the eve of independence after the Portuguese revolution, which was itself caused by officers in the Portuguese military who had fought counterinsurgency in Angola and Guinea-Bissau and been totally disillusioned and in some cases radicalized and then turned against the regime. It was no longer Salazar in charge at that point, but it was that same basically Catholic fascist regime that Portugal had since the 20s. So the CIA and South Africa invade Angola, and Cuba, Fidel sends troops to defend Angola. They win, and there begins the Cuban adventure in Africa. He by the late 70s, is trying to get socialist Ethiopia and socialist Somalia to stop fighting over the Ogaden region, which is a Somali-populated area of Ethiopia. And the leader of Somalia, in 1969 there was a coup, and Said Barre becomes the dictator of Somalia. He's a socialist. He declares for socialist, scientific socialism, and he says that's compatible with Islam and the reality of nomad society. But he's also a Somali nationalist, and he has Cuban and Soviet support. The Soviets, by the way, were dragged into all this stuff by the Cubans. The Cubans would go do this and then announce to the Soviets that they had done this and had these relationships and they expected support. And the Cubans were also trying to support and engage with a recent revolutionary coup d'etat in Ethiopia, where the Dergu, I think is how you pronounce it, was another a junta of young left-wing officers has overthrown Haile Selassie, the emperor. But the problem was, both of these are socialist states, they're supposed to be friends, Cuba's desperately trying to get them to be friends, but Siad Barre is first and foremost a Somali nationalist, and so he launches a secret war using proxy forces to try and retake the Ogaden. This then spins out of control, it becomes a regular war, and when he realizes that the Cubans are also advising and helping the Ethiopians, he then switches camps and he gets aid from the United States under Jimmy Carter, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. And so the U.S. and its allies see this engagement in the Horn of Africa as a way to bleed and humiliate the socialist camp, Cuba and the USSR. The Cubans see this as really, you know, as potentially a front for real revolution and liberation. The Soviets see it maybe as a bit of that, but also definitely as a way of projecting power into the region that they've been losing power in, the kind of whole Gulf area. And the Americans, as I said, see this as a way of engaging and dragging down the socialist camp. And so both sides pour weaponry into this fight, on and off fight between Ethiopia and Somalia. And Siad Barre hangs on so desperately for so long that his own army turns on him and things fall apart. And in the first days of January 1991, he flees Mogadishu after the last of his loyal officers have turned against him. And there has not been a functioning government in Somalia since. And there's been, you know, ongoing multi-sided civil war and total state failure there since January of 1991. And then out of that comes piracy, which is all over the Indian Ocean, and weapons that flood into places like Kenya, where pastoralists like Ekuru Larman can now buy AK-47s and bullets for fairly cheap. And so the traditional forms of raiding become much more violent when people have really sophisticated weaponry to kill each other with.
We're listening to Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos, just out from Nation Books. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear more from Christian Parenti.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity, doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here. But at night, it's a different world, go out and find a girl. Come on, and dance all night, despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city. In the summer, in the city. Cool town, meeting in the city. Dressed so fine and looking so pretty. Cool cat, looking for a kitty. Gonna look in every corner of the city. Till I'm wheezing like a bus stop. Running up the stairs, gonna meet you on the rooftop. But at night it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on, and dance all night. Just like the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer.
That, of course, was The Love and Spoonful doing Summer in the City. Perhaps a bit tasteless in a program on climate change, because everything may not be all right. Still, it's a good song. And now on to part two of my interview with Christian Parenti about his new book, Tropic of Chaos, just out from Nation Books. We've been talking in the first half about a world, especially that portion of it around the equator, between the tropics of Capricorn and Cancer, where climate change is introducing a fresh dose of deprivation and violence to a region where states are weak or barely existent and the weapons flow freely. Planners of the national security state look at this scenario and are alarmed. Let's pick it up there, Christian Parenti.
So the Pentagon looks at this and thinks counterinsurgency, right? What's the thinking of the national security establishment
right.
Approaching these kinds of climate-induced and, you know, many other things as well, social breakdown-induced violence?
they see this and they realize that they're going to be called on to basically respond to this rising tide of chaos. And they've done many analyses of climate change, and they say, yeah, it's unlikely that this is going to create, you know, conventional state-on-state warfare. It's more likely that this is going to create insurgencies, religious warfare, mass and sudden unregulated migration, rise of criminality and banditry. And so the response from Western militaries is going to have to be something like counterinsurgency and the tradition of low-intensity conflict. They don't look forward to that with enthusiasm. I mean, to their credit, they take climate change very seriously. And in their reports, they generally say there has to be mitigation.
Not to the extent of doing anything about it, just...
Right. Not to the extent of doing anything about it, though actually they're doing a little bit more than a lot of other branches of government, but not because of climate change, but more just because they don't like this dependency on shipping in gallons of gasoline at $400 a gallon. So they're actually trying to change their own consumption of energy, but it's less to do with climate change. But yeah, they recognize that the armed forces are going to be the institutions called upon to deal with this set of realities that are caused by, they don't explain it in terms of the legacy of the Cold War and neoliberalism, but, you know, pre-existing problems plus climate change means they're going to be called on to fight all sorts of small wars and intervene in various places, and it's going to be low-intensity conflict, and that puts counterinsurgency front and center.
Does that mean American troops or local allies, or how they conceive, who's going to do the work?
It's different in different cases. I mean, you know, training missions, special forces. I mean, that's why you see that JSOC, the Joint Special Operation Command of the Special Forces, is increasingly prominent in U.S. military actions. Their preferred method, I think, is, you know, small teams that train and work with locals, and, you know, sometimes there'll be U.S. forces going in there. But
from the military point of view, they're thinking these are going to be brush fires, right? Or are they thinking that?
Well, you know, there are different reports, and there was one that was done not by the Pentagon but by people outside the Pentagon, and sometimes it's pretty cynical. Like one of the kind of green hawks is James Woolsey, former head of the CIA, and he wrote a chapter for this report that he was part of that was like very, very dark and very radical in terms of like how it addressed, radical in a good way, you know, in how it addressed climate science. He was like, this is real, and if there is not serious mitigation, the scale of social breakdown over the next century will be potentially beyond people's imagination, and the U.S. military will actually be incapable at that point of doing anything about that. They take the science, some of them take the science very, very seriously, but their job, the military's job, is not to create policy, it's to implement policy. So, you know, I mean, the real job of addressing climate change in some other way lies with the political class, not the military class in this country.
And what do they see? They're just looking to contain all these troubles through counterinsurgency? They think they can do it?
Well, no, actually, I mean, I don't think they necessarily say they can do it. They're not like, we can do this. They just say, like, this is what's going to happen. You know, there's going to be, if temperatures rise by this much, these are possible scenarios. These are the kind of crises that could happen. And this is, you know, these are the type of pressures it's going to put on the U.S. military. This is what will be expected of us most likely in these scenarios. And they do scenarios in terms of, like, how much emissions will increase, how hot and how suddenly the planet will warm up. Some of their scenarios deal with abrupt climate change because there's increasing credibility to the idea of abrupt climate change, that the causes of climate change build up but the effects lag and then kick in all at once. And this was sort of an outlier position among climate scientists in the 90s, but then, or in the 80s. And then in the mid-90s, when they finally extracted the ice cores from Greenland and analyzed them, that was the first time they did that in the mid-90s, they saw that, in fact, there was evidence that the climate system didn't change gradually, slowly over hundreds of years, but that causes like CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere could build up, build up, build up, and then the effects would kick in, the effects which had lagged would kick in suddenly rather than kick in incrementally as the cause increased.
one of the features of this climate transformed world will be increased migration. We've already seen that, and likely see a lot more of it. You quote Joe the Plumber, I believe, saying, "Put up a fence and start shooting people." Is this this part of what's going on in the southwestern U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably most people who support brutal and draconian anti-immigrant policies don't think about climate change. But there are some who do, and I quote them, and I think that as climate change becomes more and more undeniable, that there's a real risk of a kind of green fascism, of an armed lifeboat mentality, that like we have this little piece here, the United States, and we can't afford to let other people into the lifeboat, and we need to militarize the borders. And I mean, you already see that.
Well, they want to keep the problem as contained between the two tropics as they can. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And thus they want a militarized border, and they want even more incarceration of immigrants. And we already have that infrastructure, you know. So that's, towards the end of the book, I return, or it's a place I've written about before, you know, return to the border and look at the repression, the surveillance, and the you know, physical infrastructure of the border, and then the rhetoric that surrounds it, of people like Brenda Walker, who describes herself as a Northern Californian environmentalist and is a real racist. If you read the things that she says, they're just disgusting, open racism. And you know, she's somebody who talks about environmentalism and racism in the same breath. And
well, the connection of like a certain kind of environmentalism and fear of the brown hordes is an ancient and venerable one, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was that unfortunate chapter of the Sierra Club. I forget where it was exactly, out west, that took on these anti-immigrant stances. Yeah, and you could see a kind of armed conservationism emerging as the mainstream stops denying climate change and has to come up with explanations and programs for how to adapt to it.
And of course, Mexico is a very fine illustration of your thesis, because you've got a combination of imperial abuse not so much Cold War, but certainly a direct application of U.S. imperialism, neoliberalism with a great force, and climate change. What's the climate change component in Mexico?
Mexico has been suffering increased drought and flooding, and that has been linked to migration. I have numbers in the book. Estimates are that 20% of migration off the land in Mexico now has a climatological aspect to it. Not that that's the sole cause, but so I profile some people like these Tarahumara Indians who come out of Sierra Maestra, and part of why they left their home was because of drought and all of the problems that caused. And they're in Juarez, and they have a little neighborhood. And there's another guy, a fisherman from Michoacan, who during an El Nino event in the late 90s, which may or may not have been caused by climate change, but fits the pattern that climate scientists say we can expect more of. During this El Nino event, there was a bloom of toxic algae, and it drove all the fish away. Because Mexico had so liberalized its economy, he had nothing to fall back on. All the old state programs of government support and government-supported fishing cooperatives and, you know, government-owned firms that bought the fish and government-owned banks that made loans, most of that had been eliminated or really eroded and rolled back, so he was left to his own devices. He went into debt himself. He was unable to pay his debts. He lost his boats and his gear, and was forced to migrate to the U.S. He became a roofer. He was deported, captured, arrested, jailed, deported. And when I met him, he was in Juarez looking north at El Paso, trying to figure out how he was going to get back there, and really hoping that he could stay out of the drug economy that is one of the only things going on in Juarez now.
But on the other hand, you know, the southwestern U.S., you know, you look at these fires. I know this is one event, but does seem like there's a pattern of single extraordinary events accumulating.
Yeah. There was the Black Sea drought last year in, this is actually not in the book, but something I'm working on right now. I mean, the Black Sea drought last year in Russia and some of the former Soviet states was the worst in 100 years. It caused Russia to stop exporting grain, put a ban on grain exports. Egypt is the single largest grain importer in the world. In Egypt, the average family spends 40% of their income on food. Last year, food inflation was running at 20%. That's not why they finally overthrew Hosni Mubarak, but the last time they had riots in Egypt was in 2008 when food prices also spiked. It's a contributing factor to why there's increased instability.
And all the ghouls on Wall Street want to speculate on food price increases.
Yeah.
Only making the thing worse. I'm speaking with Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos, just out from Nation Books. Let's talk a little bit, finally, we're in the last segment here, to talk about the politics in the U.S., which, you know, we are the... Because we were just recently surpassed by China as the biggest greenhouse offender, but I was reading an accounting the other day that a good chunk of China's emissions are the result of stuff right. They make for us. So
leakage, they call that.
Yeah, we're still the number one offender, and we can't really do anything. We can't even get a cap-and-trade bill through Congress. Is the outlook in the United States, politically speaking, as grim as it looks?
Yes, I mean, it's pretty grim, but there are things that can be done, and I think we might have talked about this one at a time. I kind of reiterated or recycled some work I had done for The Nation in the end to talk about things that can happen right now. I mean, we don't need new legislation because the EPA is empowered and obligated to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And this is the result of activists and green groups suing the EPA for 20 years to force them to take this responsibility on. So the EPA has enabling legislation. It's the 1970 Clean Air Act. And it could start shutting down some of the worst greenhouse gas emitters.
Some of our loonier congressmen want to take that away from them, right?
Right, and they're completely rational in that regard. I mean, those are loony congressmen who are funded by the coal and oil industry, the Western Fuels Association, and they're carrying water for the industries that would be targeted if the EPA really did what it has the power to do and should do, which is start making fossil fuel very expensive by regulating the emissions. So, I mean, the way the EPA works is that, you know, you can violate these laws up to a point, but then you have to pay these fines. So it puts a de facto price on carbon.
Yeah, but now we just have the president releasing strategic petroleum reserve because the price of gas is too high.
So yeah, I mean,
the politics of this are really
politics of this
very depressing.
Yeah, very, very depressing. Very horrible, horrible. And Obama's horrible on all this. But you know, it's easy for people to just completely get so depressed and retire from it. So I think it's important to remind people of what is in place. There's plenty of money to begin a transition away from fossil fuels. There's lots and lots of capital sloshing all over the international markets looking for places to invest. And with a little financial repression of the right type, it could go into funding a transformation of the energy infrastructure. There's legislation that I was just discussing that would help raise the price of pollution and also steer this money into new investments. And then there's the government purchasing. State and federal government together are about a third of the GDP. And so there's movements, but, you know, in typical Obama fashion, they're anemic and inadequate, but the federal government...
He'd be embarrassed putting the solar panels back in the White House roof.
Yeah.
I mean, he's incapable even of symbolic action.
Yeah. He did pass an executive order saying that government agencies should really take green purchasing seriously, but he has not pushed on that. He gave an extension for them to meet their deadlines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's very significant. If the federal government and state governments, which were more than a third of the U.S. GDP, actually started doing their best to buy power from clean sources, buy electric vehicles, that would be good directly in and of itself because it would help reduce emissions, but indirectly it would be very good because it would create economies of scale and give opportunities for the companies that are struggling to develop these technologies. And then if that happened, then the price gap between clean technology and dirty technology, fossil fuel technology, would close. And when that happens, then people will really make the shift away from diesel trucks to electric trucks and away from buying electricity from burning coal to, you know, wind power and stuff like that. And we'll have to do massive conservation and all that. But it's not impossible that these changes could be made if there was the political will.
And then what, if anything, could people like us do, not us personally, but the rich countries of the North do for the people in the Tropic of Chaos?
You know, that's a much more difficult question. I mean, one thing would be to allow the progressive experiments there to run their course and to not punish them and sabotage them. I mean, so the U.S. has pulled aid from Bolivia because Bolivia stands out and criticizes rich countries for their inaction on climate change, and they've been punished directly. So the main thing is get out of the way of...
Bolivia caused a lot of trouble at the most recent climate conference, right?
That's right.
What did they do?
Well, they said that the agreement was ridiculous because it and pointless because it didn't adhere to science. They said we want science-based targets. We have to keep temperatures below... The temperature increase has to be below 2 degrees centigrade, and we can't allow CO2 concentrations to go up. Really, I mean, people are talking about 450 parts per million, but it's really, it's got to be... we have to get back to 350 parts per million. But they basically, their chief negotiator, Pablo Solon, just called the whole thing a fraud and described what had been going on, which is that the rich countries were bribing countries like the Maldives, which had been speaking out in the last round and now were quiet, and they had been bought off with some money. So what they do is, you know, what they've done is a kind of, in some ways, symbolic, but they've spoken out, and it reminded people of what the real limits are, what the real goals have to be, and they take the whole process seriously and try and expose and humiliate the rich and powerful countries.
Bolivia itself, as a natural gas producer, just made some major new discoveries, which is going to develop, and I recall talking to a Bolivian diplomat about that. He said, they're a poor country, what can they do?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the dilemma that everyone faces.
Yeah.
This is a classic case of, this is such a long-term, huge problem, yet there's no way in the short term that people can think about it or address it, so it just gets shoved aside.
Now, we were talking to the same Bolivian diplomat, and I asked him about lithium development, and he dodged the question, because I think the development of lithium for batteries is stalled. I mean, what you ask about what are the states of the global south supposed to do? That's a very difficult question. That's a whole discussion in and of itself, and it's not something I really have an answer to. And there are very real problems in many states in the global south with corruption. And I mean, there's very serious problems with corruption in a lot of these progressive countries in Latin America, and particularly countries that have resources like Venezuela and Bolivia. I mean, that is just an invitation to corruption. It's very, very hard to have a lot of income coming into a state from petroleum and for there not to be just endemic corruption. The country can be run by good people with good ideas, and it's still very, very hard to manage that stuff. And I don't, you know, that gets into like a whole kind of element in development economics that it would be great if you found someone good to talk about that. But I mean, it's like, those are such vexing and intense questions. I don't know. But I do know that the U.S. should stop supporting repressive right-wing governments, should stop punishing progressive governments that do things differently, and step out of the way. And the most important thing that the U.S. could do is help make the clean technology necessary for mitigation, make that cheap and available on a global scale. And the best way to do that would be by bringing it up to scale and using the purchasing power of the U.S. government and this internal market to work out all the kinks. And once clean technology is the preferred and cheaper option in the United States, then it's going to be adopted all over the world, just like cell phones.
Well, we don't really need technological breakthroughs of a major sort to get started on this agenda either, really. It's like it's all on the shelves. We just have to take them off, or price them correctly, too.
Right. We need to work out the production processes, you know. I mean, they're still kind of done in small batches and boutique-y, and that's reflected in the price. Clean technology is more expensive than dirty technology, and part of that is because dirty technology, you know, oil and gas and coal, receives all these subsidies, but, you know, clean tech receives a lot of subsidies too. It's just because there aren't the economies of scale, and there's a lot we could do in that regard, and it would be very, very important. And, you know, all of this discussion we're having gets at another thing, which I deal with at the end of the book, which is like What is the role of capitalism? I mean, capitalism is the culprit.
Yeah, can capitalism solve this problem? And there are people who say, unless we change everything, we can't do anything about climate change. Is that true?
Well, maybe they're right, in which case I think we are looking at civilizational collapse. But I think that capitalism can solve the problem of greenhouse gas emissions.
Can capital make money off saving the Earth?
But even that's too big. I mean, it's like, the point is that can capitalism, I mean, in this book, capitalism is the villain, but it's also ultimately the system that's going to have to save the day if it's going to happen. And it's not in terms of like reconciling civilization's relationship with nature. That's something
we're
think
not going to heal the metabolic rift.
Yes, right, precisely. The metabolic rift between capitalism and nature is real, and capitalism is not sustainable. But climate change we can view as a subset of these larger problems. And the reason I make a case for capitalism possibly greening itself in terms of the energy sector in time to stave off calamity is because I don't think there is any other realistic option. The science is quite clear, and it says that after 350 parts per million of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, you enter a very serious danger zone where, among other things, self-fueling positive feedback loops get set off. So the example of the permafrost melting in the Arctic, that's an effect of climate change.
Releasing all the methane and we're cooked then.
So the effect then compounds the cause. So we don't have time to wait 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 100 years to solve all these problems. It has to be solved right now. There is, you know, another Marxism that we can call into, like the celebrating at the same time critiquing capitalism's Promethean transformative qualities. And if this really requires building out to scale these new technologies and all that, I mean, are we seriously, do we really think that, like, little self-organized communities are going to do that? I mean, this is a problem that requires immediate action by this civilization as it exists right now, and that's capitalism. And that doesn't mean, what I'm not talking about is, I'm not saying like, oh, so market mechanisms, blah, 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 blah. No, it's actually like social movements pressure capitalist states to start imposing a little bit of socialism on the market and expanding the state's footprint through more regulation, and then the process of capital accumulation can be guided and disciplined and shaped so that it can solve specific problems. And I think that it is not unreasonable to suggest, if social movements were strong enough and demanded enough, states could guide capital towards the solutions, the technological and economic solutions that we need to develop in the next two or three decades.
But it's going to take states prodded into action by social movements to do this, and not enlightened venture capitalists and entrepreneurs.
Right. No, I'm very, very clear about, I'm talking about capitalism, the system, not like market mechanisms or individual capitalists. I have no tolerance for any of that. I mean, what it's going to take is the socialistic elements of the capitalist state to be more robust and aggressive, and say like, no, here you will not invest, and over here you will, and no, you cannot take your money and gamble on the price of food. You know, if you do, it will be confiscated. If you would like to invest in wind power, okay, go ahead. If you insist on investing in coal and oil, you will not get these tax breaks, and in fact, you will suffer this schedule of escalating tax increases, which will drive the money elsewhere where it's needed. So what I'm talking about is, social policy that can shape the next couple decades of economic development, particularly in the energy sector within the world capitalist economy, because I just don't see some sort of global revolution coming in time for us to solve every single problem and also the problem of greenhouse gas emissions.
And it's either that or ethnic conflict, resource wars, and social collapse.
That's what I think, yeah. I hate to sound like a negative guy, a wet blanket, but yeah, I mean, that's what it looks like to me, having traveled around to these frontline states for the last 6-7 years. That's what it seems is on the horizon.
We've been listening to Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos, just out from Nation Books. His earlier works include Lockdown America, about the prison system, The Soft Cage, which is about surveillance, public and private, and The Freedom, about the war in Iraq. I must say, climate change is an issue that leaves me in a state of political despair. We have the technical means to deal with the problem, but it looks politically impossible to do anything about it, at least in the USA. Imagine a politician saying that gas is too cheap, even at $4, or that Berkeley needs more high-rises because mass transit requires density. Or imagine a politician trying to euthanize the oil industry. Instead of using the high price of oil now as a way of pushing alternative energy, our worthless president releases oil from the strategic reserve to dampen price pressures. It's all very gloomy. What's not gloomy is this song, This Heat, by the Sicilian math rock group Uzeda. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Till next week. Bye.